personal views and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are their own and are not legal advice or official statements by their organizations. All right. Hello, my name is Debbie Reynolds. They call me the Data Diva. And this is the Data Diva Talks Privacy Podcast, where we discuss privacy issues with industry leaders around the world with information that businesses need to know now. So today, I'm very excited to have a guest that I follow for quite a while on social media, Pedro Pavon, who is the head of privacy, data policy, and ads at Facebook. Hello.
Hey, I wish I was the big boss, but I'm just one of several. But yeah, that's the job, and this is me. Thanks for inviting me, and I'm super excited to be here.
Yeah, well, we met. So actually, I attended a webinar. It was a summit that you were speaking at last year in 2020 a big idea, I believe.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I do remember.
And you really stood out a lot because you're authentic. So I don't think I know anyone who's like you, and you really stood out that way. And then you have so much swagger. I love.
I appreciate that. Swaggy P. That might be my nickname on the streets, but or maybe I just gave it to myself. But no, I appreciate that. Look, I'll tell you, like, I'm a plain spoken person. I have strong points of views on some things, and you know, I don't think they're that controversial. So I share them widely and loudly. And the other thing is, like, look, not a lot of people of color, people from my background in this space. And so I'm so privileged and lucky to be able to, like, have people be interested in what I have to say that I'm not going to waste the opportunities to, you know, demonstrate Latino excellence wherever I can. So, that's kind of what motivates me to be the way I am. And hopefully it doesn't land like I'm a jerk, but, like, you know, just trying to keep it real on the streets. That's all.
Yeah, you're just being you. And actually, when I saw you after, first of all, I was really impressed by just you and your presence and just your fluidity with how you talk about privacy and just things in human life, because privacy is about humans, right? So you really bring a human perspective to that. And also I commented when I first contacted you, and today I was very impressed by your Biggie Small portrait painting that you have on your wall. So it definitely makes you stand out. So I
appreciate that. You know, like, I can tell you a brief story about how that came to be. First of all, I love Notorious Big, and him and a couple other 90s era rappers are my favorites, including Tupac, whose portrait is upstairs in my living room. Here's the thing. When I worked at a law firm, I decided I wanted to put some art up in my office because I was spending so much time in it. And somebody had gifted me a Wu-Tang Clan 36 Chambers record, like the actual vinyl, in the case. And for people who aren't familiar, like, Wu-Tang Clan is obviously one of the greatest rap groups of all time. I argue music groups of all time. And that was their first album. And the cover of the album was, you know, nine men, African-American men, in ski masks, essentially, right? And then, you know, it talked about the music or whatever. And so I put that up in my office, and it didn't land well with the firm. They, you know, thought I didn't project like a business appropriate image or whatever. And I said, look, and I was an associate at the time, but I remember the conversation because a senior partner approached me and said, you know, is this what you want to project? I said, well, look, first of all, no clients come in here. I'm just an associate. It's not like the public is seeing it, but even if they did, I don't see how it's problematic. And second of all, I'll take down the Wu-Tang Clan album record when other folks take down, you know, their Pink Floyd posters and their Grateful Dead posters and their, I can't remember the country music, Hank Williams Jr. poster. Okay. Like, when those come down because they were all over the firm, I'll take mine down.
Yeah, right.
So I'll trade you Elvis for the Wu-Tang Clan any day, but I'm not taking mine down just because it's not your musical preference. It's not happening. Now that I'm a little bit more senior and, you know, whatever, I decided, like, I'm going to project an image of myself that's authentic. And this is the kind of music I listen to. And these are my favorite artists growing up and my idols as a kid. And so I don't mind sharing that with the world. And I don't think it should be controversial at all. And I'm glad you like it.
Oh, I love it. I love it. And see, that swagger is coming out. So this is great. Well, I would love to just get a sense of yourself. I mean, you obviously have had a lot of jobs in technology. So a lot of the themes through your career is kind of technology and law.
Yeah.
And so I can see how privacy weaves into that. As I said, we were at Salesforce when you and I first got to know each other. And you've also been at Oracle. So what is going on right now in privacy that really captures your attention, whether you're concerned about it or you think it's good or bad? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, look, to me, what's interesting about like some emerging tech around privacy, like pets, privacy enhancing tech, and the use of like automated systems, automated recommended systems. There's a lot of potential there for creating like tremendous economic opportunity and business opportunity, right? But there's also tremendous opportunities there to like make the world a more privacy friendly place. I think privacy enhancing technologies have tremendous potential to like change the amount of data that is necessary to run the types of technologies that everyone loves and enjoys, like social media, et cetera, right? And so the more, what really excites me is the amount of investment I'm seeing into research and study around those areas. Doesn't mean I love everything that people are trying, but I definitely applaud different companies, including mine, but also Google and Apple and others, for at least taking it upon themselves to experiment with new ways to power their technology that embrace principles like data minimization anonymization, which is an impossible word for me to say. But so like that's exciting to me, and I feel like right now is a cool turning point, because hopefully we can pivot from, we need as much data as possible to do, you know, to run ads or to personalize content, to we are building technologies that require the absolute least amount of data necessary to do the same things. And I see that transition happening. It's slow and it's hard, but I'm really excited about it.
Yeah. I feel like with a lot of the regulations now, they're really trying to tie data collection to purpose, where I feel like before it was like, let's just collect as much as possible, and then we figure out what we want it for, you know?
I think that's right. And the rules aren't allowing for that approach anymore. I don't think anybody necessarily set out to collect as much data as possible with like malicious intent, right?
I just
think the technology wasn't there otherwise, and experimentation by engineering people, you know, like the nature of that process is very much like, give me as many tools as possible. And that, and a lot of data was one of those tools. But, you know, the tides have changed, rightfully so, in my opinion. Data hoarding is no longer viable. And so, you know, there's just a lot of experimentation and research and study into ways to, you know, make the internet run that maybe are less data intensive. I think it's a great shift.
Yeah. And then a topic that you talk about in your work and some of the posts that I've seen, and, you know, you've seen my posts as well, the problem of bias. Comes up a lot, and that's something that you talk about a lot, and I'm concerned about. So what are your thoughts about bias? Where are we going? Are we going to get better, worse? What do you think?
I think things are precarious right now. You know, we see all of the controversy around facial recognition technology, right? And how there's like these, Joy at MIT, and she has like a documentary now, right, about facial recognition. Yeah, which is excellent, by the way.
It's amazing.
It's worth watching. And what I love, let me plug that documentary, features all women experts, right? Like, what a beautiful statement to make during a documentary about bias and discrimination, right? And so, like, I thought it was well executed. What we found is that, like the data sets, we talked about all the data hoarding that have been used to, model train all of these cool automated recommended systems and AI systems that we take for granted, have biases built into them because society is biased and the data reflects that bias, right? It also doesn't help that historically, like, the engineering decision makers at all these tech companies are men, and particularly white men. And so when you layer all those things on top of each other and then you try to create a fair environment, what we're learning is that while no one might have malicious intent, you end up with, an implicit bias outcome anyway, an outcome that is implicitly biased anyway. And that's problematic in just basic things like, you know, facial recognition on my phone, but also on some very serious things that involve people's livelihood, like decisions about loans, decisions about freedom, right? In the criminal justice process, decisions about economic opportunity, like recommendations for buying real estate and et cetera. So we have to guard against these problems. I don't know that anyone's provided like a silver bullet solution to deal with all of this. I don't think that exists. But I'll tell you what a good first step is, including people of color and women in all of the decision-making and engineering processes involved, because we're best suited to flag these things and say, have we considered this? Have we considered that? I don't think a room full of white men is going to solve this problem. And so my hope is that and that we're heading in a different direction, and we're being inclusive in who we decide gets to do the heavy thinking on this, so that when we do the work, that translates into diverse people of different backgrounds, talents, and experiences working on the solutions. I think we're headed in that direction, and that makes me hopeful, mm-hmm. But we have to stand vigilant.
Yeah. I think one of the challenges I've come across is people debate whether there's bias at all. So to me, that's a big problem. And part of that, in my opinion, is the way the internet is, where you really only, you know, some people assume that the things that they see on the internet are the same things that other people see. We mm-hmm. know that that's not true. So if you are looking at something, you know, like my boyfriend, he's Jewish, he sees totally different things than I see. And it's amazing to see how different they are. So I think, you know, if you're someone who doesn't have that level of friction in life, I would say, or, you know, you haven't had those experiences, you may think, well, I don't have those problems. So why is bias a problem in this arena?
I think that's right. And, you know, there's the other issue. And I hear this sometimes when I'm on the speaker circuit or at conferences, which is, you know, people talking about the AI, the algorithms themselves, and saying, look, they're agnostic. They are only responding to the societal biases that exist. The algorithms themselves aren't biased. They're just being responsive to what's happening. And so the problem isn't a technological one, it's a societal one. Overwhelmingly, I've heard that case made by white men. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to make that case if you feel like the bias doesn't affect you negatively, right? Right. Like, my thought process and reaction to that is that that's an incomplete analysis, right? Because technology doesn't exist in a vacuum. It is here to serve people. And if the ultimate outcome of employing the technology is that certain groups are impacted negatively in disproportionate ways, then that technology doesn't work. Whether you think it's a societal replacement or not, the technology doesn't work, and we shouldn't use it if it is amplifying or perpetuating outcomes that either reinforce negative, false ideas about people, or perpetuate, unfair outcomes for groups that are historically marginalized and underrepresented, or maybe potentially generate new groups to be, marginalized and not well represented and not benefiting from the technology equally. And so I hate that analysis. I think it's incomplete. And whenever I hear it, I push back pretty hard.
Yeah. Me too. I don't like to hear that. Partially because I feel like two things are happening. One is, you know, there's a testing that happens on kind of a smaller group of people, and then you sort of jump to the conclusion that you can push this on everybody, and it hasn't been tested on everyone or whatever. So that's kind of a false thing in and of itself. And then when you're thinking about databases, you know, if someone went to Google and searched and nothing came up, they would say, Google sucks. It doesn't work, right? So, so they have to give, you know, a database. You want to have a result, whether it's the best result, if it's correct, you want to throw something up there. So in a facial recognition thing, if you can't get like an exact match and it didn't come up with some things, people say, oh, this doesn't work. So let's say, well, let's throw up these people, you know, they're 70% match, you know, and sometimes people feel like, you know, they abdicate their responsibility to technology. It's like the evil robots taking over and they can't do anything about it and stuff like that.
I think that's right. And look, it's a collective effort. Like no one group has all the right answers here. But we're going to have to work together. But most importantly, we have to allow for these debates and these discussions and the work that needs to be done to be tense, for there to be friction, for people to feel vulnerable and feel, have to deal with defensive reactions. Because if we don't, you know, like, homogenous decorum isn't going to solve complicated problems that affect different people, different types of people in disproportionate ways. And so I think we have to be ready for some tough discussions and some tough actions ahead. Yeah. If we want to get this right and if we care about fundamental fairness and equity.
Yeah. And the problem is, I know when people talk about regulation, although I'm not against regulation, I think smart regulation makes sense, but a lot of these harms, especially as they relate to anything biometric, the harm can be so detrimental that the law is not going to catch up in time. So, you know, I'm all for prevention and being able to do things in proactive ways and talk about things at a design level so that we can prevent some of this stuff. What are your
thoughts? Yeah, and I think that's good. It's a good approach. And also, like, you can implement all the prevention controls and prevention mitigation techniques you want. When particularly when an algorithm goes out in the wild, it's never clear how it's going to play out, which means you can't just cut stuff loose and then see what happens. You got to cut stuff loose and stay on top of it and monitor it closely and make sure that there are, mitigation techniques employed to sort of guard against the algorithms, right? And you got to do that on your own. I feel like that's a responsibility of the companies and organizations that put them out. And where we see this not happen well was in the, like, that algorithm that was designed to, like, I don't remember exact specifics of it, but basically, like, evaluate a teacher's performance, right? Oh, yeah. That thing was just cut out there, black box, and then all these tremendously great teachers were being, you know, mis-evaluated, I guess, if that's a word, or, like, just, like, graded poorly, right? Mm-hmm. And another example of that is these, like the parole and probation and limited release algorithms that were helping judges and other decision makers decide people's freedom, right? Yeah. And there was so much bias in the data sets used to make those estimates that people of color were being treated one way versus the majority group, and that one way was significantly more harmful. Yeah. We got to prevent things before they happen, and then we all also have to actively monitor and police our technology, and it's a never ending process. There's no like, okay, cool, this is done. Like,
right. Whereas an iterative process, it has to always be improved. And then too, so you saw the documentary Coded Bias with Joy, and
that's
it was
one.
Just amazing. And then she brought up something that's really interesting in this. Documentary, which is when you're using data and algorithms and they're trying to predict things, what they're doing is looking at the past and assuming that the thing that happened in the past will happen in the future.
Right.
And that was one of the problems with kind of this parole thing, where they're like, okay, this person did this thing in the past. We think they're going to do it in the future, and that may not be true.
Yeah, and also a lot of the data set about recidivism is based on neighborhoods and zip codes and locations that tend to be over-policed, underrepresented by, political power, underfunded. And so if you, the obvious biases involved in that, well, the biases might be obvious to us now, but when it's some mathematical equation in a black box making these decisions, it creates tremendous concern. Yeah. Not that, by the way, like a white male judge making these decisions is doing a particularly better job, by the way. But at least we can hold that person accountable and look at their patterns and decide whether or not they should wear a robe and be in the privileged position to make these decisions about people's liberty. But like, I'm not sure how we hold an algorithm accountable.
Yeah.
And I also am not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure how that happens. So, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. It's hard. And I think right now it's such a hot potato issue. I feel like, you know, everyone who's involved has to take some level of responsibility. So even in that example in the documentary about the teachers being evaluated by this AI, it was really, you know, regardless of what the system said, the humans that were involved should have been able to say, wait a minute, this is not right, instead of sort of abdicating or saying, oh, well, the computer told me this, so this is the way things should go.
That's right. And look, and here's another, like, I work in the ads business, right? Like, the threshold for value, about, you know, for personalizing ads, I'm going to make a number up, but let's say it's 70%. Let's say that 70% of the time you see an ad and the algorithm got it right, right? And I'm making that number up just for this example. That might be okay, because the societal harms from getting it wrong 30% of the time, and we have to decide this as a society, but are less intense than an algorithm deciding my freedom. It is not acceptable for an algorithm to get it wrong 30% of the time for anybody, right? Like, right. I can't imagine anybody trying to make the case that an algorithm that gets a liberty decision wrong 30% of the time should be used by courts. And so I guess the point I'm making is these thresholds are going to vary by use case and application and context, right? So like an algorithm decides whether I can unlock my phone with my face or not. If Apple gets it right 80% of the time and 20% of the time I have to put in my password, that's not a big deal to me. I'm fine with that, right? But if it's a police scanner with facial recognition, and 20% of the time it's pulling over the wrong person or accusing the wrong person of a crime or labeling the wrong person as a suspect, that's unacceptable. And it's the same technology, but it's just being used in different applications. And this matters greatly. And so for companies doing research in these areas, they need to think about, well, what use cases and what applications do we want to use the technology in? And it may or may not be ready for use depending on what the case is. And I think where situations affect people's health, economics, or freedom, you know, the threshold should be extremely high.
Right. And I think in an evidence perspective, the threshold is high, right? Mm-hmm. The problem is this sort of happened. This is happening kind of as evidence is being created sort of in the moment, I guess. Mm-hmm. And actions are being taken before things get to court, so where you have to authenticate it, you know. So there was an example, I know that you've seen this, about some guys that were arrested because they thought that their driver's license picture matched like video surveillance of a store that the person went to. So they were arrested, and the police who picked this guy up, even said that he didn't look like the picture. But the computer told them that this was the guy, so they picked him up, and then he went in front of the judge, and the judge said, this is clearly not the same person, you know. So they eventually let him go, but I mean,
but now, wow, he had to go through this process,
right? So now he has to fight against the computer. And what if they thought, you know, he did look like that, you know what I'm That's saying? Right.
And not just that, like, now he has to deal with the humiliation and trauma of going through this for no reason. He's just an innocent person, right? Who just was going about his business, and some math formula decided that he was going to have a bad day, but that turns into a bad month or a bad few months or just an overall bad experience. You know, and back to my point about accuracy, overall accuracy can be a misleading indicator too. Because if you've got an algorithm, for example, that's getting it right 98% of the time, but then you look at that 2% of the incorrects, right? And 90% of the incorrect ones affect Black people. That's a problem. Like, right. You know, that's a gigantic problem, right? Because, and so like, it really matters. It's not just enough to say that, you know, we have overall accuracy and effectiveness. You got to look at that effectiveness through the lens of different groups and make sure that, you know, that even in the small margin of error, there isn't a disproportionate impact there. So we've got to figure out what the overall margin of error threshold is for something. And that, I think that gets higher depending on how it impacts people's lives. And then what, you're never going to get to 100% accuracy because that's not how AI works, right? And so let's say you get to 99.9% accuracy. Well, then you got to really focus on researching that 0.1% and make sure that that 0.1% isn't disproportionately affecting groups and negatively.
Yeah, and I think too, part of it is kind of statistics can be beguiling, right? Mm-hmm. We're talking about people. So yes. If you're a person who's pulled over, you know, because someone thinks you look like someone who committed a crime, statistics doesn't tell me anything in that moment, right? So the fact that it's impacting people in negative ways, we can't look at it like, oh, well, you know, 90%, like you said, 90% is okay. 95% is okay. It really isn't. If we're not looking at, you know, where we get it wrong and how we can correct it.
I think that's right. And in some ways, like, look, police have been getting things wrong forever. Okay. I mean, we can turn on the news and see a lot of police doing a lot of wrong things, but we have this entire process to hold them accountable. It doesn't always work. And it needs to be improved, but at least we have a way to hold human beings accountable through the criminal justice system, through the civil court system and other ways. I worry about accountability when it comes to algorithmic decision-making, because like corporations are going to argue they're not accountable over time. We're going to see these arguments,
right.
You know, organizations that buy these technologies are going to argue that they're relying on them. And so they're not responsible. So like right. Who ultimately, when these algorithms lead to life and death decisions, and look, and I'll be straight with you. Like, I hope there's never another wrongful police shooting, but we know that we live in the world where, you know, when you're a black or brown person, particularly a man, and you capture the attention of police, you're immediately in danger. That is a fact of life,
right,
in America especially. And so my hope is that that doesn't also translate to when you are capture the attention of an algorithm, right. You are also officially in danger. And I think, unfortunately, some of these technologies got out ahead of common sense and were deployed too quickly. And I'm happy to see people like Joy and other leaders kind of like helping reel some of that stuff in. And I applaud cities like San Francisco and Oakland and others that have said, you know what, you know, facial recognition doesn't have a place in policing, is period.
Yeah.
My hope is, I live in Atlanta, my hope is we roll something like that out here too, because, you know, our police department doesn't have a great track record either.
Yeah. I guess one of my concerns, especially with people trying to use these databases for policing, is that I feel like if you're trying to create, you're trying to find a needle in a haystack, why are you creating bigger haystacks?
Correct.
So you're making, you know, I don't think the police department has like a good bucket where they throw people, like this Correct. Is the bad people bucket, this is the good people bucket. So once you get into that system, you're almost automatically sort of seen as a suspect until you're not.
I think that's right. And I worry a lot about like police investigation transforming into all time, real time police surveillance, mm-hmm. right? I don't love that communities of color tend to be where all the police cameras are, tend to be where all the police officers are. Because it creates a chilling effect on the community. It perpetuates false statistics about criminality. Meaning, like, if a white neighborhood was policed as much as a black neighborhood, I'm certain there'd be as many arrests because white people commit crimes at great rates too. Like, it's just like if there's no cop there to stop them, like then nothing happens, right? Or to engage. And so, like, I worry about the surveillance state that is sort of emerging, which is like police use of like doorbell cameras, police access to doorbell camera footage, police access to like, you know, installed cameras in neighborhoods, you know, police vehicles that while they patrol are scanning license plates and doing all this stuff. I'm not a super fan of any of the above.
No, me either.
Yeah, any of the above. You know what? You want to be a cop and you want to protect the community? Well, you know, some good old fashioned police work and investigation, I'm here for that as long as you do it within the law. But the idea that a way to prevent crime is to observe me at all times, not here for that.
Yeah, right. And your example about certain communities being more heavily surveilled, if you think about it in terms of a data collection effort, sometimes people think the absence of data is telling you that it isn't happening in other areas. So that is a problem in and of itself.
You're absolutely right. And then there's the other point of like the testing dilemma, which is, well, we'll test it. Look, they're not rolling out like community cameras in like the world's, just think about this. The world's wealthiest people live in the most private spaces. This is the reality of the world. They live behind gates. They live, you know, behind, you know, across moats and private islands. Why do they do that?
Right.
Why? Mm-hmm. And not most of the richest people in the world are not celebrities. They're not Hollywood stars. Right. So why do they do that? And then turn around and look at the like least economically advantaged communities and people tend to be the most surveilled, the most watched, the most harassed by police. Why is that? Because it's easier. Like, that's why. And so it not only is it easier, you know, it creates this false sense of protection for the elites, right? But like, hey, right. The situation is handled across the train tracks, right? And but what it really is the institutionalization of discrimination and by the government through the police wing of government, because in the end, that's what it is.
Yeah. We said a moat. I was driving in Potomac, Maryland, and I literally saw someone who had a mansion that had a moat around it. It was hilarious.
I believe you. And like, look, I'm a very private person, you know, and if I could afford an island with a moat, I'd probably go live there, but I'm running from the cops.
Right.
Right. So I'm sure other rich people are doing the same thing. They don't want to be scrutinized. They don't want to be this. They don't want to be that. And as we can see in some examples of like ultra rich, a lot of, not a lot, but it's the potential exists for, you know, privacy to be used to hide bad behavior. Of course, right. Like look mm-hmm. at, but don't say that that's a thing about poor communities, because look at Harvey Weinstein. Okay.
Right.
Like, this sucker bought an island so he could go do his dirt in the dark. Right. You know, you know, and so like, it's not a function of like, oh, well, if you don't have something to hide, then let me watch you. Like, you know, bad people are going to do bad things. And if you have more resources, you're going to use those resources to your advantage. Right. This has nothing to do with economics. It just has to do with access and leveraging your advantages.
Yeah. Well, what do you think? So I feel like there's a new caste system being created, in a lot of different ways about data. So the people who have data have more advantages versus people who don't, or people who have insights have more advantages. But the other thing is, for the U.S. privacy laws as they're being created, a lot of them are around consumer activity. So if you can't consume or you're not consuming, you know, you aren't protected in the same way. What are your thoughts about that?
I agree. I mean, that's my actual thought. Like, the presumption of a buyer or someone engaging in economic activity as a prerequisite for protecting their privacy is elitist and paternalistic and problematic for me. And I've raised this issue many times. Not a lot of privacy elite thinkers want to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. I think part of the reason is, historically, the people who get to sit down in ivory towers and think about privacy are super educated, wealthy, you know, people with access to lots of resources. And so that's an uncomfortable conversation. But people like me, you and others are raising this concern. It's tremendously important for me. And it doesn't just stop at if you're, you know, privacy, excuse me, economic activity as a prerequisite for privacy protections. It also, to me, is regionalistic paternalism, in the sense that, like, you know, I applaud Europe for taking the initiative and, you know, redesigning the EU privacy directive into GDPR and creating what is essentially like a benchmark moment in privacy protection. And I think the Europeans meant well, and I think they mean well with a lot of the efforts that are underway now. Mm-hmm. However, I do worry about the fact that there's this propensity by Western policymakers to think they know best, mm-hmm. and to say that their rules should apply globally to everybody.
Right.
Because I don't think it's anybody's business in Brussels to be telling anybody in, I don't know, pick a place, Mumbai, how to think about privacy. Right. Like, I just don't think so. In fact, you know, you would argue that lots of people in London, for example, you know, caused a lot of problems in Mumbai over the last 150 years, right? But right. by telling them what to do. The same yeah. thing goes for Latin America. The same thing goes for Africa. Like, I think regions of the world and countries within those regions and groups within those countries should decide for themselves how they think about privacy and how they balance that against other interests. Because it's very easy to say, okay, well, the Western world has built these amazing, particularly the United States, has built these amazing tech companies and tremendous amounts of wealth for lots of people and generated huge economic growth by exploiting data. Well, now we don't want that anymore, so let's throttle that. But what about the tech companies developing in Latin America right now? What about the tech companies developing in Africa right now? Are they not going to be able to take advantage of the data that the big incumbents now have? Is that fair? I don't know.
Right, yeah. And what do you think about silos? So I feel like a privacy professional in any type of organization, you have to be able to break through those silos because data touches so much of what happens in organizations. And because organizations, especially in corporate, have been very siloed, right? You know, everyone is sort of like Sam's workshop. Like, you do your part, and then I do my part, and then we get it together some type of way. Where privacy, I feel like you have to be able to reach across those silos and communicate with people. What's been your experience?
I think, you know, historically, privacy has lived in this like compliance corner of companies like operations, right? And data protection in general, which includes cyber as well, right? Like just like IT and some lawyers and some compliance people, and that's their job, and everybody else going about their business. I think we're seeing a tremendous change where privacy is sort of now being like, especially where I work, by the way, you know, thinking about privacy, advancing privacy is becoming a part of everyone's job by design. I think that's great. I think that is a tremendous step forward. There's much more work to be done to unsilo thinking and to transform privacy from something we have to do or else we get in trouble to, if we get it right, it's good for the business. Like, not just that we don't get in trouble, but like we can grow, we can create products designed in ways that people are more interested in, et cetera. I think that's happening. There's more work to be done. You know, the other piece of the puzzle here, as privacy comes out of its kind of corner and, you know, becomes part of the broader consciousness of organizations and companies, is to make sure that that broader consciousness includes voices that are diverse. For the points we said earlier, like, privacy is not privacy is not something that everyone thinks about the same. And so making sure that there's room for debate and strategy and application of privacy controls and privacy rules within organizations is important. And so you just can't have one point of view prevail and decide that's your privacy point of view.
Right. Everyone else has to just deal with it.
Everybody has to get in line with what you say. And there are companies out there saying that. They're saying, yeah, this is what we think. Everybody get in line. I don't think that's a way forward. I think that's paternalistic. And I think that that undermines equity. Yeah. Inclusion. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you definitely haven't been shy about your thoughts. So this is going to be an interesting question. You probably answered it already. But if it was the world according to Pedro and we would have to do whatever you said, what would be your wish for privacy, whether it be regulation or anything, either in the U.S. or around the world?
That's a really hard question. But if I was king, the most important principle of any privacy action must be that the application of it be fair. Mm-hmm. That's hard. I could spend 2 hours trying to unpack that and probably won't make a lot of progress. But my biggest concern right now as a privacy practitioner is that we are not listening enough to groups who we historically don't listen to as we develop a worldview in our profession about privacy. And that concerns me greatly.
That's a great answer. That's a great answer. And I agree. I share your thoughts. I think you know, we must be related in some way, because I think
we
agree on this very much, and I'm happy to see your voice, you know, the people really listen to you because you really stand out. And you have a lot of swagger, as I said before. And you're really smart about these things. So I really like that you're thinking about these things in these ways. So, yeah.
Well, I appreciate it. And I look, and it's mutual. I'm a big fan of yours, and I can't wait to have you on my podcast. So me and Andy can pick your brain on some of the work you're doing. And I'm very grateful to the not just way you spread important information to large groups on social media and in other ways, but the way you frame a lot of the issues. It's important, and I'm just good to see a strong, smart Black woman leading the charge. I think this is great for the profession, and you're setting a great example for others coming behind you.
Oh, that's the biggest compliment. Thank you so much.
It's just facts. It's not even a compliment. It's just, that's just what it is.
Well, yeah, we're definitely have to, I definitely would be excited to do your show and probably have to have you back again. You're great.
Oh, whenever you want. We're friends. So whenever you want to hang out, I'm here.
Well, thank you so much. This is great. This is great. So we'll
thank you, my friend. And look, I'll say one more thing. I don't think you do a video podcast out there, but like, I'm digging the scarf. It's amazing.
Oh, thank you.
The scarf is looking fire. So nice work on that. The rest of the world is missing out, but I got the scarf.
Oh my goodness. Well, thank you so much. I may have to do a picture, a screen grab of this one.
I think you should have. You dress up all nice. I'm still here like a bum, you know, but it's fine.
People have to see your portrait, your BU portrait.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, well, thank you so much. And this has been great.
Thank you, my friend. We'll talk soon.
Okay, bye-bye.